has its season, everything has its time. Show me a reason and I'll soon show.
Hi, I'm Ed Jaffe. Welcome to JaffeWoodwinds.com. Today in our next video in the Woodwind Legacy series, we're going to take a different approach than we have over the last several years. In the past interviews, we've talked with woodwind artists in different aspects of music. We'll talk with jazz artists, woodwind doublers, classical players. But today we're going to look at the musical theater world. And the musical theater world really provides the greatest amount of jobs for woodwind doublers. And that has been the case probably for the last 15, 20 years. As a result, I think it's important that anyone pursuing a career in woodwind doubling understand the nature of musical theater and what it entails. And the people who are most influential in our lives in that regard are the conductors. And today I'm joined by three gentlemen who I've had the pleasure of knowing and working with over the years, and who I think really represent the best aspects of what a conductor does and how they carry forth their responsibilities. So let me introduce you to, on my far right, David Chase, Charlie Altman, and Constantine Katsopoulos. These gentlemen together have been responsible for conducting, music directing, or music supervising over 45 Broadway shows over the last several decades. And we're very thrilled to have them here today. So gentlemen, thank you for joining me. And I want to start off just by getting giving everybody a chance to meet you individually a little bit. I guess we'll start with Dave. Just how you got into musical theater and then how that getting into musical theater eventually propelled you into becoming a conductor, music supervisor, et cetera.
Well, the short version is that I actually have no musical training. I took piano for 5 years as a kid. I hated every minute of it. I hated practicing. But in high school, there was a fantastic drama teacher who I actually played, Charlie will appreciate this, played second keyboard in Pippin my freshman year of high school, and went from there to an onstage sort of career for the rest of high school and most of college. Found that I loved theater, loved music, and after college started, because I could play piano, ended up playing Forbidden Broadway in Boston for almost 4 years, which is, that was my training in finding out what musical theater was. Read a lot, listened to a lot, finally said I'm going to move to New York, and did off-Broadway shows, subbed at a couple of Broadway shows in the early 90s, and then in 94 had the good fortune to, having had worked with, yes.
Easy for you to say.
Yes. a wonderful musician named James Raitt, who had done the original arrangements for Forever Plaid off-Broadway. He was hired to be the music director and arranger for the Damn Yankees revival in 1994, and he was actually quite ill at the time with AIDS. I had actually never conducted in my life, but James had the sort of, he just looked at me and said, I'm going to be dead, you should be a conductor. And so I was his associate. He actually did, we went first to the Old Globe in San Diego. He conducted through opening and then came back to New York to go through more health issue things. Then we came to New York. He conducted the first Gypsy Run and two previews and never came back to the theater. So my story, he basically gave me a huge gift, which is the confidence to say, this is something, I believe in you, and I still conduct with his baton.
Wow. So. And I was fortunate to sub and then take over a chair in that production, and I had no idea you had never conducted. You were clear as can be.
Well, thank you.
That's
it's just luck. No, I wow. Listen, the job is to communicate.
Right.
And, there's lots of ways to communicate to, you know, whether it's communicating to people talking like this or communicating to musicians. If you know what you think the music is and can communicate that, then that really is what we do as conductors. Yes, there's a lot of technique that can be learned, and I try to never stop learning and trying to pick up. You know, I remember one of the best pieces of advice I got, Don Pippin, who was a conductor as well, wonderful conductor, kind of, I was playing piano, rehearsal piano at Radio City in the early 90s, and I just knocked on his dressing room door and said, like, tell me about conducting. And he gave me some phenomenal sort of things, like, just remember to breathe with the woodwinds, remember to, you know, all of these things that you sort of know about, but I'd never really thought about. And that was also a lovely gift.
Huh. So that's
interesting. So that's the quick version of my story.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting story. And I know you for many years, but I had no idea. Wow.
The sad sort of capper in the story is that James passed away about 6 weeks after Damn Yankees opened. I do think about him all the time. And my oldest son's middle name is James. So, in honor of him.
Nice.
Didn't mean to bring the room.
No,
down,
I understand. You know. that's part of the deal. Yeah. Okay, Charlie, how did you get started?
So I had a random start. I always was musical, and I always was interested in theater. And I don't know if I ever had a specific interest in bringing them together for musical theater. But all growing up, I played piano starting when I was four, and I played a couple other instruments. And I always loved to sing, and I loved to perform. And in my mind, either in my life I wanted to be an actor, or I wanted to, like, play backup, you know, sing backup and play keyboards on the road for Chaka Khan or something like that. Still a dream, but, you know, I'm releasing it.
You still can. There's still opportunities.
Maybe. I think I might need to be a woman, and I might need to be a different ethnicity, but you never know.
Still can.
Exactly. So I kind of fell into music directing in high school. I auditioned for, I got to high school and I was like, ooh, it's freshman year, I'm going to audition for the big musical. And it was Little Shop of Horrors, which is a very small cast. And they pulled me aside after the auditions. They said, look, everyone loves you. You're a freshman, so we're not really looking at you for any of the leads. And we're kind of creating an ensemble and we could put you in there, but you'd probably be bored. You wouldn't have much to do. We know you play piano. Would you want to assist the music director? And I was kind of like, well, let me think about it. I don't know. I wanted to be in the show. And then I was like, I guess, sure, because why not? And so I played piano for all the rehearsals and for the show, and I kind of helped this music director out, and she was very, very cool. And I got to see that side of things, and I said, well, this is kind of interesting. Maybe I like this. So all throughout the rest of high school and college, I was still undecided, but I would like act in a show and then I'd act in a show and then a music director show. And by the time I graduated college, I'd started finding work in the summers doing summer stock and whatnot. And so it sort of seemed like that was going to be the career path that would be more fruitful. So it's sort of basically what I pursued afterwards. But amazingly enough, my first job in New York was subbing. And then I took over on this tiny, tiny, tiny little off-Broadway review that inexplicably ran for 2 or 3 years, where I was like, the piano player was on stage and sang a song and did these voiceovers. So I think like my acting chops helped me get my foot in the door there. And then my Broadway debut was with Martin Short's, he did a show called Fame Becomes Me that was his spoof of one-person shows. Mark Shaiman wrote the music and was on stage at the piano kind of as like, here's my music director, Mark Shaiman. And so I was originally hired as his understudy. And then over the course of previews, he became aware that his role in the show was so big that it was too crazy for him to music direct the show as well. And I kind of got promoted. You know, it was this crazy moment where we did three cities out of town in our out-of-town trip. And by the time we got to San Francisco, which was our first one, we knew that there would be certain things that he couldn't conduct because he had a costume change or he was in the next scene or something like that. So they had this elaborate system. He was on stage on a piano. They had a camera on him. There was going to be a camera on me. Everyone in the band was going to have a little TV monitor. I was going to have a foot switch to go back and forth between who was conducting what. And we'd never really mapped out what it was. And so in the middle of tech, you know, we took our dinner break and Mark was sitting, you know, with piles of paper, like doing rewrites on his computer. And I was like, Mark, I know this probably isn't a great time, but can we please just find 5 minutes to go over who's conducting what, because I just want to be prepared for that first band rehearsal in 2 days or whatever it was. And he's like, it's just all you. I was like, what? Okay. He was like, you heard me. Renegotiate your contract. You're conducting the show now. I was like, this just happened. So that was sort of my big break. And then from there, I went on to do Next to Normal and Godspell and Pippin and a bunch of other cool stuff. So
cool. An interesting break-in.
Yeah. So random, but I feel like most people that I know, even like, you know, mm-hmm. having James say, I believe in you, you're going to do this. It's always like, it's like Shaman did the same thing for me. He was like, I think you can do this and you're going to do it. Go.
Wow, interesting.
So it was, and then Larry Blank, who was the orchestrator on that show, became a great mentor too, both in giving me confidence. He was, because he knew I was sort of thrown in too, and he was like, you could really do this. You, like, he gave me confidence that I had what it takes, but also would sort of pull me aside and be like, okay, in this moment here, this is a little confusing. You could, you know, so he was a huge help to me.
Wow, that's a cool thing. Now, Constantine, you came to Broadway mostly, I guess, from your roots in as a classical conductor of symphonic orchestras. So how did you get into musical theater from the symphonic career?
Well, I mean, I've always done a lot of different styles of music. I've known I wanted to be a conductor since I was about 6 years old. I had a neighborhood piano teacher that I was taking piano lessons with, and one day I came into the lesson. We did our piano lesson, and we're on the way out, and she says, here, I want to show you this book. Later, I figured out it was Max Rudolph's Grammar of Conducting.
Grammar of Conducting, right?
And there was a squiggly line there, right? And it was the 4-4 pattern. And I looked at that and I said, that's what I want to do. Probably because I didn't feel like practicing the piano. And as I say to many people, yeah, the piano is the instrument that I learned how to play, but you wouldn't know it now to hear me play. And so, you know, I all through school, I was always thinking about it, and, you know, up in my room with my stereo conducting to opera records. My mother was an opera singer. My house was kind of crazy because my sister's a cellist.
Right, the Philharmonic.
The Philharmonic. Right. One of my brothers is a composer, and the other one played instruments when we were growing up.
So you had no choice.
I had no choice. And when I was in high school, when I was a junior in high school, the drama teacher at the high school, this guy named Bob Lowy, was doing a production of Stop the World at the local YMHA. And in high school, if you were a senior, you could do what's called a senior project, which meant you didn't have to go to classes for 2 or 3 months in the second half of the year, and you could just do this project. Well, none of the seniors wanted to do it. And I said, well, I'll do it. Mm-hmm. And speaking of doublers, when the set of parts came, I didn't know anything about doubling. I opened the first read book and I said, it's absurd. It's terrible. How can they possibly expect one person to play all these different instruments?
And keep that feeling.
Exactly. And that was the first read book, and there were 5 read books. And I didn't know anything.
Right.
So I got friends of mine in the high school band and high school orchestra together, and we made an orchestra and we did the show. And then after high school, I went to Boston Conservatory for a year as a piano major. And left after a year, found my conducting teacher, Vincent LaSalva, at Juilliard, took his class. And then I said to him, Maestro, if you need a rehearsal pianist, I'd love to play for you and help you. And he was doing opera in Central Park every summer. And so he took me up on it, and I became his assistant for about 4 or 5 years. And never really had a conducting lesson with him. But I got to see him work, and he also didn't have a driver's license, so I drove him everywhere. I got to hear him talk, and I was just curious, so curious about conducting, and went to concerts and opera performances. Didn't really intend to work on Broadway, although I'd done a lot of community theater as a music director. I also studied conducting with Semyon Bychkov for a summer. And the way I kind of got into the Broadway scene is in 1992, the Secret Garden tour was going out. And Dale Stuckenbrook, who was the concertmaster of the Broadway company, Broadway Orchestra, recommended me to Michael Cosrin. And I was interviewed and got the job. And so it's a little bit of formal training.
Right.
A lot of curiosity and a lot of School of Hard Knocks. My first Broadway show was a show called Cyrano the Musical.
Yes.
Which ran way longer than it had a right to run.
Well, I actually subbed on that show.
That's I remember that.
Yeah, and I remember it well too, because I had the first day I was subbing on it, I had a car accident in Newark, and it was in the wintertime, and I was stuck in Newark. Didn't have a chance to get home to get my instruments to come in and make the first sub. I borrowed instruments.
Oh, my God.
And I actually thought, no way am I coming back here. But you were great, and you carried me through the whole show. And if I missed, I didn't have a right to be in the music industry. You made it easy. I remember that specific day vividly.
Well, I mean, that's our job. I mean, I often think about this in terms of the whole subbing thing on Broadway, because there are so many conductors that shall remain nameless who have a real problem with the subbing scene. And the fact of the matter is, it's our job, and I'm sure you guys will agree, to do whatever's in the best interest of the performance and that particular production.
Absolutely.
And so if that means a first-time sub comes in, we got to help them out.
Right.
Help them make a...
Well, and it's also
the reality, like whether or not, there are times that I'm not crazy about the rules or the situation with subbing, but that is what the rules are. So it's a waste of energy to be upset about it and fight back against it. And there's also a lot of positives to it as well.
Well, one of the reasons...
in the heat of battle, you have to just say, this is what it is. Let's make the best show we can.
Well, thanks for that thought, because the truth is, as you said, there are many conductors that I've encountered and others that I've heard about who won't even acknowledge the sub, meaning the sub is there, even for the first time, not even say hello, nothing, not one cue. And that's not only today. I mean, I've experienced that in the 1970s when I started playing on Broadway. And there is this almost divide between the conductors who wanted to help you, like all of you do, and others who want to just see if you can sink or swim without any cue. But today's, you know, the nature of Broadway today, excuse me for interrupting, but is so different than it was in the 70s and 80s, because the gig on Broadway today is everything. There's not the other work that we had available in recording, in club dating, in touring with acts and so forth. Generally, that is available, was available in the 70s and 80s. Today, Broadway, for a commercial player, is all that really exists that pays a livable wage with some benefits. So the stakes are higher, and the competition is greater, and more wonderful players are trying to play on Broadway now than ever before, because there's a void. So we're more dependent than ever on the conductors.
But I think that's a key thing, which is that we as conductors understand that you wouldn't be sitting in that chair as a sub unless, A, you're a brilliant player, and the person who hired you to sub for them had confidence in you. So I feel like it's my job as a conductor to not only, you know, make sure I, as you said, you go up and you introduce yourself and you say hello, and if there are things which you know are going to be problem spots or that may be problem spots, you know, just talk about them.
Right.
You know, you try to give some notes afterwards. Very rarely do people really screw up. Yeah. I mean, or let me put it a different way. The only reason that people screw up is because they haven't prepared. You almost never encounter a situation where someone isn't a good enough player. Now, it does happen because suddenly, you know, it's Christmas time and, you know, and everybody's this way and that way. And, you know, you've got the wrong combination of people, that kind of thing. But you really, I do feel like it's our job to facilitate the best possible performance from a sub.
Well, and the interesting thing about that is that you in what you just said, you talked about people.
Yeah.
And use the term people. And the fact of the matter is that it should at least go without saying that the level of musicianship is extremely high, and it is extremely high in New York. But also from a humanistic point of view, I have never met a musician that wants to do a bad job.
Exactly.
Yes.
That doesn't happen. Everybody wants to succeed, everybody wants to do well. I mean, the level of preparation to come in and sub on a Broadway show is pretty intense. And 95-98% of the musicians that come in to sub on a show are really well prepared to do that.
Yeah.
It's our job to help them out. Because, again, it's in the best interest of the performance.
Exactly.
You know?
Right. Well, and I think, you know, you talked about the one thing that'll make people screw up is if they're not prepared, and I think that's certainly the biggest thing. But I've also seen people be less successful than they might have been because they were incredibly nervous. Mm-hmm. And so, and it's just my own personal thing, but that's why I go out of my way to introduce them, to build them up, to say, hey, we have this person playing tonight and whatever, and make them feel welcome and make them feel right. Like we have confidence in them, so that hopefully they won't be nervous and that they'll be able to bring their A game. And I think a lot of people, and I see this with directors, with actors, I see that in all facets of the arts, where people sort of say, well, like, well, let's see what they got. Let's see if I can almost feed on making people nervous to see how they handle it. But my attitude is, at the end of the day, we want a good show.
Right.
And if people are nervous, the chances of that happening are not as high. So yeah, let's...
Nothing is gained by...
You know, yeah.
Well,
exactly.
Yeah, it's our job to create a work atmosphere that lets everybody do their best work.
Exactly.
You know.
Right. It seems like common sense what we're saying.
And it's
here,
amazing how many people do miss that, you know, but
yes. And we're all in it together.
Part, the good people, I think.
Yeah. But I think your statement. Yeah. No one wants to come in and do a bad job. It's not conceivable. Everyone wants to do their best. And but a lot of times, just by the nature of the stakes being higher, there are fewer people are taking off from shows today than there were 10 years ago because of the change in the structure of our contract, and in order to gain health benefits, the regulars have to perform more shows. Mm-hmm. There's less outside work for them to take off. To.
Yeah.
So that when you do get the call to go in and sub, again, those stakes are higher. You want to do well. You know there are others who are subbing, and you don't want to go to the bottom of the list. So, you know, all of this builds up anxiety. And
the first show, the stakes couldn't be higher because
absolutely.
It's effectively your audition. Mm. I mean, it's the most, it is kind of the craziest system
it's
where
punishing.
Like you don't actually
yeah.
get a proper audition.
Right.
You have no kind of rehearsal process unless, you know, every player is different. I've seen players who have said to their subs, come in, let's spend a couple hours and let's play through everything and let me give you some feedback. But that's kind of rare and it's completely on the player and if they choose to do that or
that's
not.
That's right.
I'm an incredibly neurotic person, and if I'm going to have anyone sub for me, even if I'm just playing keyboards in a pit, I'm like, let's get together for hours, let's play through everything, but, you know, that's not usually how it works. Usually it's like, here's the book, ask me some questions, come watch the show, and good luck, see you at opening. And by the way, opening is your audition.
Right.
So it's
tough,
really
it's
nerve-wracking.
Tough scene, yeah.
So right. The potential to be nervous is enormous.
It's true. I have a friend, I don't think he'll mind me mentioning his name, Lawrence Feldman, who's a well-respected
Lawrence.
Musician in town.
Love him.
And Lawrence said something many years ago to me, and it's proven to be absolutely true. He said, you know, it's harder to sub on Broadway than it is in the Philharmonic.
Absolutely.
Because let's face it, when you're subbing in the Philharmonic or what, unless you're the concertmaster, which is not going to happen as a sub, you might have a solo. It'll be a small solo. You'll you'll be basically playing in sections. The music is generally well known. If it's not, if it's a new piece, then everybody's on the same level.
Yeah.
But on a Broadway show, you're coming into a situation where everybody knows the music in their sleep by, you know, the time you start to sub, which
and
is
some of
the...
them are sleeping.
You didn't have to give away the
no,
secret.
Yeah.
And so you're walking into a pit where everyone knows the music backwards and forwards, and they know everyone's part just by osmosis. And, anything that's a little bit different than the person who is the regular there is going to stick out. Even if it's maybe a better interpretation, it's going to stick
out. It's
going
to be different.
Well, and that's also an interesting point because it's very similar to being an understudy in a show where culturally in the world of a show, especially on a long run, everyone wants what's familiar and what hits their things. And so it is a tricky thing where like being a great understudy is different than being a great performer because your job isn't just to do a good job. Your job is to be as close as possible to the person that you're stepping in for so that you're not disrupting anything in the fabric of the show. So, you know, like you said, you might have a great interpretation of something, but that's not necessarily what people want, you know?
That's right.
However, I, as a conductor, I always appreciate it when people bring a little bit of themselves to it, but you have to sort of stay within... You have to stay within a narrow boundary of like, I can't go really too far because at some point I have to play the show as it is and as it's been established. But I love, especially when it is long run where I hear something and go, ooh, I like what they just did there. That was, okay. They're really paying attention. They're really feeling this music and they're bringing something to it.
That's true.
But you don't want to bring so much of it that it's like, what's going on over there? Did you hear him play that? You know what I mean? And it's a fine line and it's hard to,
you can't quantify it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it depends also on the style of the music. Some styles yes. lend themselves more to a little deviance, and others really, you know, I imagine certainly in a show that's a little more classically oriented, where, you know, you're not going to have a rhythm section that's going to be reinterpreting the lead sheet, that it's...
Well, but the other issue, I think, that makes it even... That raises the stakes even higher, I think, these days, especially the past 10-15 years, is the fact that orchestras are smaller.
Right.
Every part is so
transparent.
You know, the original orchestration of West Side Story was 5 woodwind doublers, 3 trumpets, 2 horns, 2 trombones, and, you know, the string.
No violas, because the house violas.
Yes, that's right.
And a bassoon book, solo bassoon.
Yeah.
Nowadays, you know, you get a show where you've got 2 or 3 read books, and you're playing more instruments
at the most 2 or 3 in a new show.
Right.
Yeah.
And so
3 if you're lucky,
you know. If you're lucky.
Yeah, and you know, now you're down to maybe 1 trumpet.
Right.
It used to be 3 trumpets was the norm.
Yeah.
Right. And then you could the solos went between the first book and the second book, and the third book was a supporting book.
Right.
Now then it went to 2 trumpets, and people were wondering why trumpet players were cracking more.
Yeah.
Well, because they didn't have the support underneath.
Exactly.
And now it's down to, you know, shows with 1 trumpet, and the second and third trumpet parts are in a synth.
Yeah.
So
or a clarinet.
Or a clarinet. Yeah, exactly. So it's
there's no support in the section anymore. You know, it's much less stressful to come in and sub West Side Story if you're, you know, playing 3rd violin out of 5 or whatever, to, you know.
Right.
And not that it's not still stressful, but you have the support of a section. You can sort of, you're playing probably the same note as the person next to you, and you can really lean on them a little bit.
Right.
Versus like, now I'm the violinist, and I'm the one string player in the whole orchestra, and I'm blending with a synth player, and everything I play is basically a solo, you know.
That's right. And it's true. The show we did that ended a year ago, Pippin, we were a band of, I think, 12.
Yeah.
The original was 24.
Yeah.
So right there, you know, just that downsizing of the orchestra's pits makes every part more transparent and makes the player much more responsible, in a sense, having to be on every moment.
Absolutely.
You can't just say, okay, I'm playing in the section here, I'm doubled Phantom of the Opera, I'm playing a second violin part's doubled with 3 or 4 other people, etc. No, every part is unto itself now.
It's very
different. Which brings me to woodwind doubling, in a sense, because when we're doubling, and especially with the smaller woodwind sections today, every instrument now becomes a solo instrument. And if you're playing 4 or 5 instruments on each book, you can't coast.
Well, it's much more exposed.
Right.
Oboe playing isn't really as strong as, you know.
Right. I mean, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, when shows were generally orchestrated, in a way where you would expect 5 woodwinds or at least 4 woodwinds, and they would all play saxophone, and then your flute, clarinet, oboe, bassoon would be divided among the books. Today, if you have a saxophone, sometimes there's 1 saxophone book, and they hire an oboe player who plays English horn, a flute player who plays piccolo, alto, flute, straight players. But when we're doubling, we don't have that opportunity. I mean, we have to be excellent on every one. But in your experience, what have you noticed among the doublers as being perhaps... if there's a weakness, there's a particular instrument or an instrumental family stand out to you as being weaker in your experience in working with doublers over the your careers?
It's interesting because I think, and I could be completely wrong about this, and I don't know enough about what doublers' principal instruments usually are, but I would imagine, and you'd correct me if I'm wrong, that most of the time, doublers start out on clarinet and sax.
Well, that was the traditional way, certainly in the 30s, 40s, 50s.
People coming out of the swing band.
Yeah. Right. Well, also because of the predominance of Audie Shore and Benny Goodman. They were the rock stars of the day, and clarinet was the first woodwind people generally played. Saxophone was a natural following. The flute came much later, generally. Basically, in the 50s, it became more of a required double. Oboe and bassoon attached to any of those were sporadic and really didn't find the days until maybe the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, I mean, of course, it's the double reeds that tend to be the weakest.
Yeah. Or they're strong on the double reeds and then the other instruments are a little weaker.
It's either or.
Because it's like, I started as an oboe player and now I'm trying to learn the sax. You know what I mean? But it's usually pretty obvious. Once the double reeds come into the equation, it's usually pretty obvious whether they were the first instrument or the second.
But it also depends, you know, and the way that it becomes apparent is when oboe writing in a doubler's book has generally more solo passages.
Yeah. Yeah.
Than anything else, because it's a different color than the clarinet or the saxophone.
Right.
Bassoon writing has traditionally had, bassoon books have had less in terms of solo stuff, so that the bassoon, bass clarinet, and Barry sax chair could get away with playing some bassoon and it was okay.
Because you're sort of getting lost in whether it's doubled with the cello or with,
Right. And also a lot of the writing for the bassoon makes use of its ability to be sort of comical in nature.
Yeah.
Where the oboe is not written comically.
Yeah. they're not putting the lyrical line on the bassoon that's supposed to make you.
But the revival of Porgy and Bess that I did, the fifth reed book had no bass clarinet, but had bassoon, clarinet, Barry sax, and tenor sax.
Wow.
So, and I think there was one other instrument in there as well, but it was primarily a bassoon book. A lot of bassoon solos. And then the player was expected to be able to play bassoon in the quote classical style and then, pick up the Barry sax and swing a little bit.
Yeah.
What I find fascinating is in the West End in London, they've forgotten what double reeds sound like. Because starting about, I'd say 20, 25 years ago, they basically got rid of all double reeds, all oboes and English horns, and replaced them with soprano sax.
Hmm. And, interesting.
And
so we got to move to London. All right.
But you got to bump up on your soprano sax.
To the point where when Billy Elliot came here, all of the oboe solos and English horn solos could have been played on the oboe and English horn, but they wanted the sound of the soprano sax because it sounded right to them. So their ears had completely adjusted away from, especially quoting Swan Lake, they wanted the soprano sax. And you go, but you can have the real thing. It's like, no, that doesn't sound right.
Wow, I wonder why
I think it was probably because they couldn't find enough people who were good, strong doubles and doubles.
Well, and when it comes to to oboe playing, the style of oboe playing in England is very different than what it is here. The sound and the whole, it's a very different thing. So that,
It's interesting. Yeah,
that may have some, when I listen to recordings, you can always tell an English orchestra
versus an American
orchestra or a German orchestra. And because the British style of oboe playing is even very different than the German style.
Yes.
Certainly more different than the Viennese style.
And interesting because, it's interesting because that's different for different instruments. The flute playing in London actually is not dissimilar from what we have over here because Geoffrey Gilbert really, who was the founding father of the modern flute playing in England, really was a Moyse influenced player, and that French school has basically been the predominant school here. Clarinet in England has come a little closer now to what we have here, which is a sort of an amalgamation of French and German. So it's different for different instruments. That's interesting. I wonder if that has anything to do with orchestrators not wanting to.
Well, the other factor that is important is that everything that an audience hears is coming through speakers. So a soprano sax, when played into a microphone coming through speakers and altered in whatever way in terms of EQ and so on by a sound designer.
I see.
Can, if you don't know, can sound like an oboe or an English horn.
Interesting. Yeah. But you've hit on a very big topic, which is, I think, the main reason why we no longer have large orchestras is sound design.
Yeah.
Is because
absolutely.
I mean, if we had the ability to go back and hear what live orchestras sounded like on Broadway pre-Promises, which is when it really started. So, 50 years ago, it would feel very different. And you know, how many people sitting in a Broadway audience have actually heard real live music?
Right.
You know, they're almost, you know, unless you go to the ballet or the symphony, you don't know what live orchestral or instrumental music sounds like.
That's so true.
You know, true. Because if you go, you know, you go to a rock concert or a, you know, something in a blues club or whatever, that's all still coming through speakers.
Yeah.
So we don't, we no longer know what live music sounds like in a Broadway theater because we've taken the first three rows of seats and covered over the pit. We've sunk the pit. We've pulled the stage out further. And there's this belief that all you have to do is just, we'll just put mics down there, turn up the volume and, you know, and so yes, in a way, that's part of our problem is that we have made ourselves less necessary to what the live theater experience
But I don't
is.
Think that's our doing. We certainly wouldn't have wanted to do it. I mean, that's a financial decision on the producer's part to be able, if they can pay 12 people instead of 24 and no one's objecting to it, that's more money in their pocket.
But we lost the audience's understanding of the difference between 12 and 24 and the difference, you know, Red Press still talks about when they were doing Gypsy, the original Gypsy with Merman and Out of Town in New Haven, he would watch her every night right there because his head was above the edge of the stage.
Right. Well, I did some shows in the 80s where we were still out front and could see everything. Wow. And it was a wonderful experience. And it actually affected the way you played.
Yeah, sure.
Because you felt more connected to the production.
Well, and you understand what's happening on stage, which is, it's interesting. Anytime I've done a show where a player, it's so rare that when you're in the orchestra, you get to see the show. But over the course of a long run, usually somehow it happens. Maybe it's like, oh, well, I had to sub out because I have this thing that was ending at 7:45, but then we got out early and I was nearby. So I thought, oh, I'll come by and watch it. And anytime I've had that happen, the musician has always come up to me afterwards and said, I didn't understand. Oh, that thing that I do in this song, I didn't realize that's what it was for. And now, and then they play the show so much better because they're connected to it.
Yeah. Well, the thing about, you mentioned it, that it's a financial decision. It's a financial decision that I think was originally rooted in some of what you're talking about, which is it's a cultural decision.
Yeah.
And that starts even way back before the whole synthesizer thing.
Yes.
And then the other thing is that orchestration, even with a larger orchestra on Broadway, say maybe 19 or 20, has changed. If you listen to that original cast album, Gypsy, and you listen to those orchestrations, every time Ethel Merman is singing, there's nothing underneath except strings.
Yeah.
And then the brass and woodwinds would come in to accent and punctuate.
Right.
And then you'd really hear the orchestra soar on a dance number. Right. And it's very different now. Yeah. I mean, there's really terrific orchestrators. Let's talk about Jonathan Tunick as an example. I mean, Jonathan Tunick is, I've worked with him a couple of times. And as orchestrations have come in, I look at the score and I think, there's nothing on the page here. What's this going to sound like? And it always sounds great. He has, Tunick has an understanding of the theater. He has an understanding what it means for a human voice to sing with and over an orchestra. And there are other orchestrators even working today that understand that. And then there are those who don't understand, who will consciously think, well, everybody's mic'd.
So you just turn them down.
Yeah. Right. I can do whatever I want.
Right.
Yeah.
But the miking, I think, is really what changed everything because... now there's been a trend. Sometimes there are these shows that will do a revival and it's the original orchestration. And I remember, I think it was South Pacific was the one where I had this conscious thought. I was so excited. I was like, God, it was like 30 musicians or something like that. And you went to hear it and I was like, where are they? But it's because it was the original orchestrations which were orchestrated for actors to sing over the 30 players with no mic.
Right.
So there's not a lot going on until it hits those. And so... You know, in some ways, I guess it does make sense that things shrunk, got smaller once
decreased.
You know, we had these reduced orchestras once you can mic, ironically, once you could mic the singer to be over the orchestra, you'd think that, well, now let's make the orchestra more robust. But instead it was like, well, now we're also micing the orchestra so we can fine tune it and you don't need as many. And you know, we can have four string players mic'd and it'll sound the same, and we can get the same volume out of it, but it does, it doesn't, the sound waves don't, well, you know, play with each other the same way.
Acoustic principles, which Don Sebesky understands very well when it comes to strings, and certainly in the recording studio, which is that you do things with strings in multiples of three.
Yeah.
And so if you have three violins, that starts to sound like a section. The fourth one doesn't really add much until you get to six. You know, and, right. and all those kinds of interesting mm-hmm. ideas.
Yeah. Again, it's also affected the nature of orchestration because it's not going to be heard in the most acoustic manner, and so much of it is controlled by the people running the board. And so the orchestrators themselves are now affected goes down the line of command.
It's also really easy to orchestrate, say, in Finale or Sibelius and hit playback and go, right. Oh, okay, that works.
That sounds okay.
You know, which is very different from the live experience.
Yeah. Very different from pencil and paper.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Very, very different.
Yeah. I just want to touch upon a subject that, and I've been in the theater 35 years, I guess, playing shows, that I'm not totally clear on. What is the difference between a conductor, a music director, and a music supervisor? Because those titles are all ascribed to all of
it's
you.
It's a very good question.
So,
and there is no answer.
And it's different on every show.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, I think the conductor is the most clearly defined because whoever's conducting the show is the conductor.
Right.
Usually it's also the music director, but not necessarily. But I think music supervisor has taken... There's a lot of different versions of it, but there's sort of two... The two most common situations where you have a music supervisor are either a show opens with a music director who is also the conductor, it becomes a huge hit, it's running for years, and after a year and a half, that individual gets another show and leaves, but says, well, I'll stay on as supervisor. So bring someone in to take over the day-to-day operations, not just of conducting, but running cast rehearsals, casting, etc. But I'll remain the supervisor. I sort of know where the bodies are buried. I was there when everything was set. And I'll come back and I'll check up on it. And, you know, I'll stay involved. Versus if there's a music supervisor from the start.
Right.
And still then I think there's different... machinations of how it works, but it's, you know.
My understanding, well, I mean, I didn't start hearing about the music supervisor title until...
Cameron.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Until the British shows started coming out.
Yeah. Here's because I talk about this a lot, mm-hmm. because people ask it all the time, and I have to explain it to every single producer every time there's a new show, which is that there was a time when there was very clearly one job, which was the music director. It's when shows did not run a long time, and also when the composers were alive and active. Mm-hmm. Then the composer basically was making all the musical decisions, all the creative decisions, and the music director was the person who carried them out and conducted the orchestra, and then the show ran for a year, and then it closed, and you went on to the next one. What changed was a bunch of things at the same time, which was that shows started running longer, so literally the baton had to keep getting passed. And the problem was that, okay, if you're the director of a show, you have creative input into what the show is. You walk out the door, you're still the director. You're the choreographer of the show. You walk out the door, you're still the choreographer. The way it was working, though, in our world is if you're the music director and you made every creative decision, because it's a revival, because the composer is dead, because the composer is a pop composer who sends in a demo and that's all they do, Elton John, or you know, or the composers are musically illiterate and can't read or write music, which doesn't, you know, Irving Berlin didn't read or write music. There are plenty of people who are brilliant composers, but so somebody has to do the job of creating the musical sound of the show and make the musical decisions. And that was, for a long time, the music director. But the problem was, you walk out the door and you're no longer the music director. Like, you leave the show, even though you were as much a part of the creation of it as the director and choreographer, there was no mechanism by which you retained some kind of creative, you know, acknowledgement, whether it's on the title page or financially. And this really started to happen when shows started running a long time, and simultaneously with Cameron McIntosh shows coming over from the UK, where the creative, you know, whether it was Les Mis or Cats or all of those kinds of shows where they had to be creative and created, and somebody other than the composer was the primary musical force behind them, writing all the interstitial music, writing, you know, all the arrangements, and wanted to maintain some sense of both control and also, you know, keeping every single version of the show essentially identical. Who's the person who's going to look not just at the one show running on Broadway for this year, but the 17 versions of it running all over the world? And that's kind of where Music Supervisor came about. Now, it still does change meaning all the time. And there was a big move. Ted Sperling actually started a committee in the late 90s, at the union to say, I want to go back to the conductor is the person who conducts the orchestra. The music director is the person who makes all the, who is what we would now call the music supervisor, who makes all the musical decisions. And it was all towards trying to define those terms to reinstate the music director, Tony. It didn't happen. That's how we ended up with the orchestrator, Tony, but no music director, Tony, because the answer was, we don't know what you do. We can't define it. So what ultimately happened is, because in the West End, for a variety of reasons, the term music director now means conductor. The person who conducts the show is the music director, and the person who makes all the musical creative decisions is the music supervisor. So because they are pretty clear on that, that's now kind of moved over here. And I mean, I remember because there was a show that was being done by British producers that, and I had already done 6, 7, 8 Broadway shows at this point. And they asked for my resume, and he said, well, he's never music supervised a show. It's like, what, you know, so we don't know if he's creative. And it's like, but I wrote every single note of the accompaniment for this show, and I wrote, did everything, you know, and just because the terms were so different. So, yeah. And, you know, and it sort of started, I think, in the last really 15 years, just kind of mutating towards, we don't use the term conductor now to mean the person who conducts. That is the music director. And I found, I mean, having been the music supervisor and not the music director of several shows in the last 5 or 6 years, what's really helpful to understand as I start saying, okay, they are not, music supervisor is not the music director's boss. Ideally, it's that the music director is dealing with the day-to-day running with, you know, with the orchestra, with the cast, with the rehearsals, with the sort of making things happen. The music supervisor is looking at the whole thing from a creative standpoint. But that's my definition.
Well, that's very interesting, because the music supervisor, when I did Porgy, David Loud was the music supervisor, and what you just described is the relationship that we had, which was really quite wonderful, because things are being reorchestrated and so forth, and there has to be that whole process of, you know, you set a number in a rehearsal hall, and at what point does it get sent off to the orchestrator, mm-hmm. and how does that work? And you know, and the way the rehearsal process in New York was, we only had 3 weeks of rehearsal, in a rehearsal room, because the show had already been mounted at ART, and the cast knew the show, but we were making changes day to day. And David Loud was the guy who
made sure that it went there, and that, yeah, it was communicating with
exactly.
this department and that department.
And getting that done. And of course, you know, we had a musical relationship, in the sense that if something, a tempo wasn't quite right, or so, we'd talk about it, and then we'd make the adjustments.
But
your colleagues. It's a collaborative environment. Or like with Cinderella, when I came into Cinderella with you, I mean, you know, the same kind of thing. We have mutual respect for each other, and for our histories, and our what, you know, and what we bring to the table, and then you can go forward with that. As a contrast to maybe the British model. I can't speak for the British model in England, in the West End, but the British model, certainly when it's imported here, which is, I think, my own opinion, flawed.
I will agree with that.
And
yes.
We could get into stories, but that might be for the conductor's forum. I don't know.
Exactly.
Yeah. But yes, the term music supervisor, when it's applied to a British show, you may not actually see that person physically ever.
Oh, wow.
It's been my experience.
Wow.
Or sometimes you see them too much, but that's
another. Well, okay.
Okay. In discussing, you know, how Broadway has changed over the decades, one of the major things is how people are hired for shows, even conductors, for instance. My understanding when I started in the 1970s, subbing and then playing shows on a more regular basis, was that the contractor, person who was considered the contractor, really had total control over the personnel, including the, in often cases, the conductors, that they would have their stable of conductors and they would recommend them to the producers. And that's how conductors would get their work, just like the sidemen would as well. And that certainly has changed over the years, because now certainly the conductors operate oftentimes independent of the contractors as far as getting their job.
I've never been offered a job by a contractor.
Okay.
So, well, I take that back. I've been said, would you like me to put your name in for consideration for a job? And I'll say, you mean about the job the director called me about 2 weeks ago? I'll leave names out.
But, yeah. But anyway, okay. But the but certainly now conductors have a great deal of say on the personnel, perhaps even sometimes usurping the contractor or having more say than the contractor on that, or sometimes a mutual agreement on here's some people I want, here's some people you want. Can you talk to the process as you've experienced it in your careers as far as the hiring of the personnel? What are the factors that go into it, without naming any specific names, but what are the factors that go into you thinking and then recommending and hiring someone for a job? In other words, what are the characteristics besides the obvious that someone's got to play well? But as we said earlier, there are many wonderful players now all looking for the same piece of the pie. So generally that's, especially in a place like New York, you're going to have a lot of musicians to choose from who all play a specific book and can do a very fine job. What are the factors in hiring that, you know, make someone stand out to you or when you think of hiring an orchestra?
Well, I mean, I think that probably all of us have, you know, over the course of one's career as a musician, as a conductor, whatever it happens to be, you know, you start to know who you like to work with. Mm-hmm. And you know, and who is right for a certain book or style of music and that kind of thing, and so you start with that. I mean, and then you know, I always collaborate with the contractor, and we have conversations about it, and the contractor might want so and so, or if I can't think of somebody that would be right for such and such a chair. I might say, well, what do you think? And, you know, you go back and forth. Mm-hmm.
And orchestrators jump in too. Yes, there are certain orchestrators who always want this person in their band.
Right. And sometimes the composer as well. There's usually too, a lot of chefs.
So it's really like a collaborative hiring.
It's not unlike casting a show where, you know, it's like the sort of the casting director, I think is an analogy to the contractor.
Yeah, that's great.
Where they're bringing people to the, you know, casting director is saying, here are a bunch of people you may not know about, I'm bringing them into audition. Some casting directors will be very, you know, have very strong opinions. Some of them will just say, here's who it is, you pick. But I think, and I, certainly some contractors I've encountered being very passionate about people, and some contractors are very much like, here are some names, who do you want? You know, I think every show is a little bit different. But at the end of the day, I, for me, personality goes into it so much. Yeah. Because as you said, if you're talking about eight players, some might be better than others for this particular show, but they're all going to be good players. It's not like, oh, that person's terrible, don't let them in the band. It's more, you spend a lot of time with these people.
In a very small space.
Doing basically the same thing every day. So it's like, who do I want to be in those trenches with? And who's going to get along well? You know, oh, I love this person, but I don't know, these two people don't really click well, and they're going to be sitting next to each other and playing a lot together, and that's all part of it. And as you said, it's, you know.
Well, and also for us, it also even starts before the band gets hired,
yeah.
Which, with, you know, the rehearsals in the room, who's going to, who do you, who do you want to have as your associate conductor that's going to play rehearsals? Who's going to be the second assistant, you know, the assistant conductor? And who can navigate that rehearsal piano mind field and then sit in the pit and play in an orchestra? And you start with that kind of nucleus. And if you know, if you're developing a new show and you, let's say, are fortunate enough to have a drummer in the room that's going to do cast rehearsals with a choreographer and so on, then you know, then the choreographer might have an opinion about who they want to have playing drums.
Oh, very much so. Oh, goodness, yes.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, both drummers, rehearsal drummer and rehearsal pianist, and you know, choreographers, directors. There are people I've had directors say, "I don't like that rehearsal pianist because they're not." You know, looking at me all the time. There are certain choreographers that have a very short list of people that they want to have there.
Oh yeah,
and
yeah,
you know, absolutely. And it, I mean, it's happened not in my experience, but I know it's happened fairly recently where choreographer insisted on a drummer. The drummer started playing the show, and it was not a good fit, and they had to replace the drummer. But it's because the choreographer insisted on that person originally. Because it's also very different to be a rehearsal drummer or pianist than it is to be a show
Absolutely.
Drummer or pianist.
They're very different skills. And ideally, you want someone who can do both. Because the other thing is, just the way the contract works with the union, it is very difficult to replace a musician once you're in the thick of it. So those decisions at the beginning become hugely important. And for me, it makes me less likely to want to take a chance on someone I don't know, just because I say, well, I don't know them, I don't know, you know. There are players who've been recommended who I end up falling in love with, and players who've been recommended who's like, yeah, they're okay. I really wish I had fought more for this person that I love. So it's tricky, and it's always funny to me when people say like, oh, well, they're, you know, they're just trying to get their friends. And I'm like, whatever friendship we have is based on the fact that we worked together and I loved working with them. So it's like, that's what it comes back to, and that's what I'm trying to continue going, you know?
And those musicians that we are all friendly with, that we've worked with a million times, will also understand if you do a show that doesn't necessarily match their particular skill set, so you're not going to use
them.
That they're going to know that, okay, yeah, I get that.
They don't want to be put in a bad position.
Exactly.
You know, but also the interesting thing about, I work with college and conservatory students all the time. I go to Indiana, and I'm working at NYU now. And what I say to them always is, be careful that you're not the person that slows down the rehearsal. Or the recording session.
Absolutely. Although, and that's a change, because years ago, and I have to tell you, this is absolutely the truth, there were guys who were noted for having a very good sense of humor, who at the 58th minute of the hour would interrupt the session. Hey guys, did you hear this joke? And they'd be into the overtime before the joke was over. And they were, and everyone knew they were just waiting for that moment because they knew they'd get their extra 20 minutes.
Well, those days are gone. You want people who are exceptional musicians who know the style of the music that you're, and you know, very often the development of a show, some of the style things can change a little bit, you know. So that musicianship has to go without saying.
Right.
But then you got to have a group of people that are going to get along with each other, and that if you even want to go further than that, that you know who their subs are likely to be.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. That's
I also think
that's
it's
going
important
far.
that the people that are hired are invested in doing the show, by which I mean they're not going to, this is going back a ways. I did a show where I remember the contractor said, well, you know, he's really busy, but he's great. And I regretted hiring that person because they were never there. And he might have been better than everybody who subbed, but I looked forward to his subs. Because he also wasn't there enough to play well and to be consistent.
Right. And that's certainly the days when they're recording it, when the recording industry was happening, and jingles and dates were plentiful, or seemingly so, but that is clearly not on the horizon. Which brings me to maybe our last question: what do you foresee as the future for musical theater with regard to its continuing success? Do you see it? I mean, we're in a period right now of great success for shows as far as audiences, and even shows that are lasting long. You know, the tradition for shows when I started was that a show would last 3 months.
Yeah.
And musicians were accustomed to having 3 and 4 shows a year, doing a show for 2-3 months, doing the cast album, the show would close. On to the next show, doing 3 to 4 cast albums.
And that was the expectation. That wasn't a disappointing run.
That's right. Or it wasn't them saying, well, I've done my cast album, now I'm leaving. I mean, really,
you budgeted for 100 performances.
Yeah.
You made your money back on 100 performances, and then you went on.
Right. And of course, now things...
Now you need to run for typically a year before you make money, before you recoup.
Hopefully, right. So for the young musicians who are looking towards musical theater as their career, as a possible career, what can you offer them as
Jack
advice?
Of all trades. Yeah. Know every style. Listen to, know your history, know style, practice, and be a good person in terms of, be enjoyable to have in the room, be a positive light, and embrace and be passionate about it.
Well, you think that's common sense, and that would be for anything, but again, what the thing that has to be emphasized in musical theater, we're doing the same music day in, day out.
But it's not. It's every single show is different.
Right. Exactly.
And so you have to find the joy of, I'm a hypocrite to say it because I can't conduct anything longer than like 6 months before I go nuts. but the idea of having, something, which you have to do every night, it's not the same every night. And that is the joy of live theater. And you have to, it's one thing for me as a conductor to say yes, because I can see what's happening and I can feel the audience, right behind me. It's different when you're, in a pit and you can't really see that, but you have to find the way to make it fresh every single time.
And it's still a collaboration.
Yeah,
it's still about the singer. I mean, one thing I was going to add to what you were saying before, I think those are the main bullet points, certainly. But the one other thing I would add is, if there's any way as a player to educate yourself on the world of theater, to talk to singers, to talk to performers, to go and see shows, and realize that when you play in a pit, it's a very different art form than playing in an orchestra. Because you are, everything that you do is to support what's happening on stage,
or it's a dialogue with what's happening.
It's all about it's all about the relationship between the players and the performers and the audience. I think there's a lot of incredible players who miss that disconnect. They're like, I don't understand what's happening up there, and then it becomes like a fight. And it's like, well, you have to look to understand what's happening up there, and even if they're doing something that doesn't make sense musically, there must be some reason that it makes sense, and how do you support that, and how do you still be a scene partner with them?
Take a show off and watch it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I kind of came to this realization of doing the Secret Garden tour, which is the first time I'd ever done 8 shows a week, and I did it for 16 months. I mean, part of what made it different is we were in a different town each week. We carried 5 musicians and we picked up local musicians, so I had to teach a new orchestra every week, and that really kind of, for me, helped me to hone my technique and everything else. But if you look at 8 shows a week as a way to do what you do better every show, in some little way, as a conductor, I would try, I'd try something a little bit different. It might not be noticed,
but you know.
But I know, and I know how it feels. It's not to say it's easy. It's really difficult to do that. And there are going to be some shows that are going to be tough to make that happen. The other thing is, the audience that came in to see show number 8 of the week paid just as much money as the audience that came in to see show number 1 of the week. And so we all get tired. It's a way to learn to pace yourself, and don't bring your phone into the pit.
Exactly. Well, and it's not just pacing. I always think of what I always try and remember. You get so insular, and in the band and with the cast, it's like, oh, it's almost like this again. I've done this 500 times at this point, but I always try and remember. Okay, but 98% of the people in the audience have never seen this before. This is their first time experiencing this. So I have to do the show for them. And I have to, and sometimes I literally will pick, I'll either pick a person that I know in my life or an imaginary person and be like, and I'll visualize them sitting in the audience and say, and so that I can somehow hook into the experience of someone who is watching the show for a first time and perform the show for them. And remember that everything is a discovery for them. Everything is a surprise for them. Things that we know are coming that are so in our body, so in our DNA. But it really is, it, in my mind, it's two different jobs. The job through opening night is figuring out what the show is going to be, figuring out how to make it better, figuring out how to make it tighter, figuring out how to make the message clearer, et cetera, and what it's, what the content should be, and then how to perfect that content. And then basically from that point on, the job becomes how do we take this thing that is established and every night play it like fresh, like it's the first time. That becomes the work. It's not about playing it well, it's about playing it new.
Well, I'm going to say exactly what you just said in a slightly different way, which is that all of us in theater or in the arts are storytellers. Yeah. And yes, the job up to opening night is, so what is the story we're telling?
Yeah.
Then as of opening night, you're going, now I'm going to tell this story to the audience every night. And every night I'm going to tell it, it has to be as vibrant, as engaging, as emotionally whatever as it was last night and the night before. And it's, every audience is going to be different.
But there is a certain mindset and a mind game you have to play to do this. Especially, for instance, when we were doing Pippin, we were, the band was in it, Charlie was up,
the most visible to the audience,
they had some air to breathe. Yeah. We were in a submarine for all intents and purposes.
No, it was that called the bunker.
The bunker.
It was horrible. Yeah.
The bunker. But you do have to play mind games with yourself. One thing I'd like to pass on to the viewers, one of my very first shows that I saw from the pit was the original production of the show, The Wiz. And a great reed player, Dave Tafani, took me down to the pit. He was playing that show. And I asked him, I had never played a Broadway show at that point. I had done some, you know, shows in school, but I had no idea of the life and the lifestyle and what one has to deal with on a day-to-day basis. And I said, well, how do you do this? Because to me, it sounded like, this is impossible. And he said, well, here's what I do. And Dave was also a top flight studio musician, recording day and night and then go to the theater at night. And he said, when I'm playing, and I played this music hundreds of times now, I know exactly my part and all, but I'm listening across the pit, trying to figure out in my mind, as if I'm taking dictation, what the other people are playing and try to visualize, if I put it down on score form, the harmony, the voicings.
Oh, wow.
And I thought, wow, that's pretty interesting. And over the years, I've tried to do that as best I can. You know, that type of mind game to stay engaged musically, but in a different way. You know, and so whatever I think anyone does to stay active within the musical environment, I think can only be helpful.
I also think it's really helpful. I mean, I love as a conductor to have people sitting in the pit, whether it's a listening or the actors in between scenes. It's like, come in and just sit and hear what we do. I try to get the director, the choreographers, all of the, you know, the general managers, anybody outside the pit, just to come and sit in the pit for a show. To see what happens here, that we are really working down here and also having a good time, but also just that other presence of somebody makes everybody play for them.
That's a great thing,
I can't remember if you, when Damn Yankees opened the second time with Jerry Lewis, were you still conducting that time?
Oh, he used to come down all the time.
He came down, and I was sitting in the lead book, and sometimes you'd hear a door open, but he used to wear this, I would call it Vitalis or something. but I loved it. He was great. He loved the music.
Yeah.
And I remember he'd look up, Jerry Lewis is looking over his shoulder and saying, you know, crazy things and making you laugh. But I asked him one day, Jerry, why do you always come down to the pit? He says, that's where I get my energy from before I go on. Because he had about a half hour or so before he went on as the devil or something like that. And he said, that's where I get my energy from. And I thought, wow, Jerry Lewis needs energy.
Well, listen, it's why they call it a musical, not a texical. It's a musical. We are in music theater because the music is what takes, well, I mean, look, we all know the reason that music exists in the theater is, and the reason people sing is because the situation has gotten way too emotional to actually just be satisfied by speech. And so song comes about. And so the music that we create is the basis of music theater.
Absolutely.
And, you know, for me, it's not just Broadway. It's in the opera house. Mm-hmm. It's wherever there's music in a theater, it's music theater. And it's there because that's what transports the audience.
And it has an ineffable power to make us feel joy, sadness, happiness that text by itself never will.
Right.
Absolutely.
I agree.
Well, with that, I want to thank you all for spending your time today and your advice and your knowledge with us. And before we leave, can you just tell us what's on the horizon for you musically in the future? What do you have coming down the pike?
I'm about to start rehearsals for Tuck Everlasting, which is opening on Broadway this spring. As in this case, I'm the dance arranger. I do that for a couple of months and a couple other little projects. And then I go to the Lyric Opera of Chicago and do King and I. With 38 musicians in an
yes.
open pit.
Wow.
And no mics on the band. Can't even call them a band on the orchestra.
That's an orchestra.
That's an orchestra.
Exactly.
Yeah, right. Great. Charlie?
That's incredible.
Yeah.
I just got back from Chicago doing an out-of-town tryout of a show that's heading to Broadway this fall called Gotta Dance, inspired by a true story about a senior citizen hip-hop cheerleading squad. So it's a real blast.
And they're called the Bernies, right?
We've changed the name. So it's inspired by a true story. It's actually about a team called the Netsationals from the Brooklyn Nets, although they
that
started
would not
when
be
it was
sensational
in,
this year.
Correct. Well, it started, oddly enough, viewers don't need to know this, but it started... when the Nets were in New Jersey, they had the worst record in the history of the NBA. They were losing every game. The team was in the toilet. They were on the verge of bankruptcy. And it really started as a PR move. Someone had this idea. They're like, how can we reinstate goodwill for the team? How can we get the team back in the news? How can we create good buzz for the team? And someone had this crazy idea. We're going to form a seniors dance troupe to perform it at intermission. Listen to me. At halftime. And they did this big open call, and there's a woman named Dori Berenstein, who's this phenomenal, phenomenal woman who directs and produces documentary films, but she also produces Broadway shows. And she saw this ad, and she said, I have to make a movie about this. She called them up, and she said, can I bring a camera crew down? They were like, please bring a camera crew down. That's why we're doing it. So she made this incredible documentary called Gotta Dance, and she said the entire... And she only set out to make this documentary, but she said the second she started rolling the cameras, she was like, this is a musical. This is a Broadway musical. I have to make this into a musical. She put a team together to write it and got Jerry Mitchell involved to direct and choreograph. And it's this great piece with a ton of heart. And... I'm describing it to everyone as the Chorus Line meets the Golden Girls. It's kind of fantastic. So that's coming up on Broadway in the fall.
Oh, that's great. And Constantine?
Yeah, I'm actually working with the NYU Symphony Orchestra this month. We're doing a concert on February 25th. The first half of the concert, we're going to do the suite from Bernard Herrmann's Psycho, from his score to Psycho. And then we're doing compositions by winners of the Film Composers competition at NYU, so student composers with film. Second half, we're doing Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. And then I have a festival in Boca Raton that I do every year, the Festival of the Arts, Boca, four concerts there. We're doing Raiders of the Lost Ark with live orchestra. I've done a new translation of Magic Flute. We're going to do a semi-stage version of that and a couple of other concerts. And then I'll be at IU conducting Oklahoma.
Excellent.
There you
not
go.
The one up you, David, but I got 50 people in the orchestra. Lots of
well,
string players.
It is funny. The first I did Carousel at the Lyric Opera last year, and the first orchestra rehearsal the cast came into, all the opera people were going, wow, only 38?
Yeah.
And all the theater people were going, oh my God, 38 people.
Well, I talked to somebody who was working on King and I when they were in rehearsal last year, and I was in... at IU doing South Pacific. Mm-hmm. And I said to this guy who happened to be studying conducting with me, I said, well, how many violins do you have in the King and I Orchestra? And he said, well, we've got six. I said, I got 18.
Well, those are the things you can do at a big
exactly.
college.
When you have to page player, right?
That's right. But that's still great that at least some of the colleges are doing these
absolutely.
Large productions. And
well, the thing about IU that's great is that this is being done in the opera program.
Wow.
It's part of the opera program, and that they're doing music, they're doing, you know, American music theater, and that the orchestra, well, they're on the campus of IU, there are six orchestras, but the, right. and they rotate the productions, and they're getting to learn to play theater music.
Right, and you know,
although that's, IU's always been good about that. I mean, yeah. My wife, who went to IU, did Mrs. Lovett and Sweeney Todd with the opera.
Oh, wow, wonderful.
In that opera program. But that was a few years ago.
And well, and you know, 80s, that, yeah. that was the thing that Tony Randall tried for so many years, to make musical theater not only part of Lincoln Center as a regular thing, but also as a standard part of every opera company's repertoire. And they would do much better if they did. I mean, certainly a piece like Sweeney Todd.
Well, but, when I was at City Opera, we did Sweeney Todd several times.
So. Yeah. But you asked the question, where are we headed? Yes. And the answer is that, like probably what happened with opera 100, 150 years ago, we are now moving to a place where traditional music theater that has large orchestras, or at least it has a symphonic-based sound, is going to become the provenance of the nonprofit organization or the colleges or the opera houses, and that Broadway, which has a much more commercial driving bent behind it, or has a commercial, it is a commercial thing, is going to keep moving towards, as you know, smaller and smaller and more synthesized, more tracked, more all of those things, because it saves money.
Yeah.
And it's also shifting musical styles. I mean, in defense, like, I think as musical tastes are changing, and as what's on the radio is fewer instruments, that's what people's ears are used to, and that's how people are, how composers
it's
are
valid.
Writing. Yeah.
yeah,
and it's not a good or a bad thing,
right.
but it is our reality. You know what I mean? And so that's what, and you know, there's always been this sort of awkward and yet very present relationship between what's happening in musical theater and what's happening in pop music. It kind of went away for a while, but you know, originally those were the pop songs.
That's right.
In the 20s and 30s, all the pop songs came from musicals, and then it sort of diverged a little bit, but I think it's coming back that way now that people want shows to sound like the music then, or now you have these shows that are created from entirely catalogs of songs from the radio. So obviously the orchestrations have to shift. What's encouraging to me is that Broadway seems to be going strong, and I think in terms of what the future of Broadway in terms of its health, I think, is oddly very good. I think in a weird way, as our worlds become more, we're on our phones and everything is digital and everything is virtual, it feels like there's a little bit of a backlash where Broadway is one of the few places that you can actually sit, your phone is off, you're connecting with an you know, there's a live audience, it is happening in real time, it's not on YouTube, it's not on, you're not watching it on your Netflix, and I think it's become, the difference of that experience is becoming so unique that it's oddly, I think, raising its stock.
Yeah, gaining traction again.
Yeah.
yeah.
I mean, every Broadway theater is full right now with like a waiting list of five shows trying to get into it.
Incredible.
I can remember a time just maybe 10, 15 years ago where there were like seven empty Broadway houses. Like, does anyone have a show that's financed that wants to come in? And
that's right. That,
it's a very different time.
I moved here in 1990 where there were, I mean, for the next 3 or 4 years, there were maybe one or two new shows every year.
Yeah. Right.
They were hard pressed to find shows to nominate for for new musical.
There was that year that I think it was Sunset Boulevard.
Sunset Boulevard,
the
where
big,
no, there was
default,
no other.
Because it was the only new musical.
I agree with you. I think I think that the digital revolution has begun to fix people in a certain mindset, and I think it's a mindset that is not necessarily a part of human nature. Yeah. And so the people are starting to turn their phones off little by little, and are starting to crave, even if they don't realize it, something that involves sitting and talking to somebody.
Yeah, live community.
Live
communal interaction.
I think that's partially
and
why.
And feeling something in a way that you don't feel, no matter how much you get involved in a story. In a movie, when it's a live person experiencing it in front of you, it hits you differently.
But also, I think when you mentioned movies, I also think that's why movie theaters haven't died.
Yeah.
You know, remember when VHS and, you know, Yeah. Betamax.
But when they thought it was going to put them out of business.
That's it. The movie theaters were going to just, that was going to be the end of it. But that hasn't happened.
Yeah.
It's because people still, whether they know it or not, want to interact with each other in some way.
And share the experience of seeing something together.
Yeah. Right, right.
It's not quite directly related, but I'm always reminded of, there's this great article I read, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, that talked about, essentially, somebody was writing saying that this is the death of music, giving music away for free over, you know, over the
airwaves.
They
said that when radio was invented.
And the article was written in 1929.
Okay, sorry.
But it's like, you know, but our, but our world, it will keep changing. It will keep adapting. It will stay healthy in some way. Just, we may not recognize where it's headed. You know, so part of this comes from, yes, I don't, you didn't need woodwind doublers in the 20s and 30s.
We had them.
You had them, and they existed.
That's right.
But, you know, Robert Russell Bennett almost never wrote for a doubler.
That's true. He wrote for single winds.
Single winds.
Or doubles, actually.
Yeah.
You know, two clarinets, two flutes, orchestral.
Orchestral writing. Mm-hmm. You know, but, and then when you started to have more of the swing-based shows, you had people doubling an instrument with a sax, or maybe two with a sax. Now, you know, it's not unusual to see four, five, six doubles on a chair.
It's more standard, actually.
Yeah. You know, and yes, everybody has to wear all those different hats, and that's part of the financial issue of just the orchestra becoming smaller. It's about also the skill of the players. We couldn't do it unless people were trained to do it.
Mm. Right.
So, you know, there, here's an opening for something, and so it will fill with people who have those skills.
That's true. Well, guys, thanks so much for giving of your time today on a Sunday afternoon, Super Bowl Sunday, of all days. I think this has been really great, and I hope the listeners will take advantage of the information you've shared with us. And we hope you'll come back for our next set of interviews on JoffeyWoodwinds.com. Take care now.